Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in geopolitical life. In parts of the UK, Parliament has been on recess, but geopolitics never sleeps. Whether it's a violent power struggle in Sudan, scrutiny over Biden's loyalties in Ireland and Northern Ireland, a flare-up of tensions in Jerusalem and around Taiwan, or attempts to read the minds of Presidents Putin or Xi, understanding what is happening in the world remains absolutely essential. To help me explore current geopolitical issues and to also take us into space, I am delighted to be joined by Tim Marshall, British journalist and leading authority on world affairs, and author of numerous books, including a new one out next week on the 27th of April, The Future of Geography. Hello, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And just thank you. And thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, people who are listening to the podcast won't have the visual, but what you need to know is that Tim has the most incredible backdrop of maps and a telescope for the future of geography. But it's the maps that are so much a hallmark of a lot of the work that you've done, because you have really drawn our attention to how important it is, whether you've got countries around you or whether you're surrounded by water as we are, that plays a huge impact, huge role really in the way that countries interact with each other. And it seems to me right now, for example, particularly I guess with China and the US almost squaring off against each other, that quite a lot of countries are rethinking their relationships to each other and to those bigger land masses. In fact, many countries are sort of almost not wanting to pick sides. I don't know if you would agree with that. Are we seeing a shift at the moment? It's a really important shift.
Well, I would argue that geography has always played a role, but it's just that sometimes it gets forgotten about in the maelstrom of news. But underpinning a lot of what happens is geography. I'm not a geographic determinist. It's, you know, it's not the be all and end all, but it's the one that's often overlooked. And there are so many examples. At the moment, Taiwan, for example, the issue there, if you drill down deep enough, you arrive at the entire Pacific Ocean, and that this is one of the keys to unlocking China's domination of at least half of it. And conversely, America, if Taiwan was to fall to China, pretty much has to retreat back across the Pacific to about the line where Hawaii is. And that sort of big geopolitical thinking is what I think is often lacking in explanations of what's happening. As I said, there are so many factors, but people rarely seem to talk about that particular underpinning geographic factors.
Well, you've written in the past week about specifically China and Taiwan, and I'm interested in that geographical perspective, because from a psychological point of view, it's such a huge landmass, and yet they are still so bothered after all these years, and one can understand the political reasons for that. But tiny Taiwan, you've got this tiny little island, and the optics of this enormous landmass. And I get the fact that they're annoyed that they can't control Taiwan. It sort of reminds me of those people who say, if I get a boob job, my life will be perfect. If I get the right woman, my life would be perfect. If I get the right job, everything will fall into place. It's as if China says, if we got Taiwan, everything would be solved. But why do you think China still needs to operate like that?
Well, there's a deep question for you, and it's tied up with nationalism, which is, of course, a psychology, as well as the geographic imperative. Let me flip it round and try and approach it from the American, why they care so much, because then why the Chinese care so much comes into play. Go all the way back to World War I, America got involved in World War One when the Germans began to threaten the shipping lanes in the Atlantic, and that was a threat to America. In they came. Second World War, there was a similar thing going on here, where if the Germans had invaded Britain, which because they already had the Atlantic coastline, if they invade Britain, they are a threat to the great sea power, which is America, because America is primarily a sea power because nobody can really attack it from the land. It's got Canada above it, who have no desire to, nor capability to invade America, neither has Mexico below it. So that leaves the only threat coming from the sea, either Pacific, the only existential threat, 9/11 is a different matter, the only existential threat is from the Pacific or the Atlantic. Right, so let's talk about the Pacific. The great international sea lanes of the world, and especially the most important ones, if you're talking about trade now, is on the Chinese half of the Pacific, past Hawaii, past Guam, into places like the South China Sea. So from the American perspective, there's a number of things going on here. If Taiwan is to fall and the Americans don't help them, all the other friendly nations, Japan, even Australia, Philippines, etc., South Korea, they all start to think, oh, in the time of need, they didn't come to Taiwan's aid. We better start at the very least hedging our bets and probably even edging towards China, because Taiwan's gone. You know, we know where the future is going to lie. Also, Philippines, for example, if the Chinese take Taiwan, they then have access to point towards the Philippines, with which they have many territorial disputes. On the other side of Taiwan, you've got Okinawa, big Japanese island, territorial disputes in the waters between them. So think of Taiwan as this big brick in a wall that is in front of China, which allows international sea lanes to remain open and for all shipping. And here's where we get to the Chinese perspective, and forgive me for the long answer, Lucy. If it is a wall in front of China, and Taiwan is a big brick in that wall, and of course there's gaps, there's a gap between Okinawa and Taiwan, there's another gap between Taiwan and the Philippines, but it's very easy in naval strategy to block those gaps. America's got 11 aircraft carriers. And at this point, China is blockaded. And China relies on imports and exports, especially exports, to survive. If it gets blockaded, it is in a world of pain. Now, it doesn't matter that nobody actually intends to blockade China. What matters is that theoretically they could, and no great power can live with that. They have to put into position a long-term policy to counter that and make sure it could never happen. Not that it won't happen, but it could do. No, it cannot. And the key to all that is the island of Taiwan. And that's the big geographic underpinning. Now, there's lots of other stuff. They want the semiconductor chip factories. They want the nationalism. They want to prove that communism is much superior to that incredibly rich democracy that's called Taiwan. So there's all those other things as well. That's the geographic underpinning. That's probably the end of the podcast because I've probably gone on for 15 minutes.
No, that is just brilliant. And it's so absorbing because you make it easier to understand. And as you say, it's multi-layered. It isn't just about the nationalism and it's not just about the commercial imperatives, but it underpins so much. But we often just always seem to go back to the psychology, the relationships of it. And I was thinking of that in another part of the world because I was on the edge of the Middle East over Easter at the time of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I was terribly struck by how differently those events were being discussed in those neighboring countries to where I was. And also,
you were in Jordan, weren't you?
I was in Jordan. And so, you know, you're surrounded by the land masses of Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and you've got Israel. And you've also got the views that are different about other conflicts. The Ukraine war is seen through a very different prism.
Yeah. In modern geography, demographics is a part of geographic studies, and here you immediately get to the demographics. It is the Jordanian elite and the royal family that have done the peace deal with Israel, which I personally think is a very good idea. The more peace deals, the better. But that doesn't mean that the population is necessarily fully supportive of the peace deal, because something like 60% of the population of Jordan are Palestinian. And of course, they might have a very different view. So, and that, you know, if Jordan, it is interesting. They really have a lack of a water issue, which affects how they look around the world. And yeah, they, you know, they have very interesting neighbors, not least Iraq, and
they
areas
also,
of instability.
And you're right to draw attention to the fact that 60% of the population has that Palestinian connection, because their thesis is, why do we have borders in the first place? You know, 1,000 years ago, we were all getting on quite fine. We were probably all in our little Bedouin tribes at various places in the desert, but there weren't these, what they would see as artificial carved up barriers that have, in their view, gone a long way to causing perpetuating conflict.
I agree with the part of your and their argument, because they are artificial borders. I can take issue with the idea why are there borders? There have always been borders. I don't buy this idea that the borders were invented by the European nation state. I also don't buy the idea that they all got along fine. I would remind my learned friend of the Abbasid Empire of Muhammad sweeping out of the Arabian Peninsula and conquering everybody, usually by killing lots of people until they all agreed to agree. So, you know, I don't think they all got on very, very particularly well. Ditto the Persians sweeping across the flat lands in front of them once they came down from the mountains of Iran, etc. However, the borders that the French and the British drew are partially why there is so much trouble today, and all that stuff and the Sykes-Picot line is still to this day being sort of redrawn. Would it all be sweetness and light if there weren't any borders? I doubt it. There certainly wasn't before the borders were put into place.
Have you ever given much thought to how you would solve the Arab-Israeli conflict?
I wouldn't. I'd manage it, which is what is happening. Let me come to the what I think is potentially a solution, but even that is very, very flawed. But at the moment, the situation is just being managed. Some situations don't have any short or even medium term solutions, and so you just manage them, and that is what is sadly going on at the moment. Long term, it's prosperity when you've got something to lose. And then there are fewer people attracted to the ideology. Now, what I don't buy is that it is always persecution and poverty that leads to radicalism. When you look at the long history of this century of suicide bombings, many of the people that carry them out and many of the people that make and design the bombs are actually very well-qualified engineers. Very well. And, you know, Bin Laden wasn't exactly short of a petrodollar or two. The Bin Laden family is, you know, immensely, immensely rich, big in construction in Saudi. However, the amount of followers of the sort of ideologies that would go for no compromise and radicalism, I think, is reduced when you have prosperity. So if we could get prosperity going in the poorer areas, I think we would reduce the amount of ideology, and hopefully the compromises which both sides need to make could be achieved. Am I an optimist in the short term? No.
Are you more optimistic about things in your latest book, The Future of Geography? You're taking us in that to a brand new political battleground, one might say, which is space. You touched on it at the end of your last book, but it's obviously something that has preoccupied you a bit more. Do you worry that we're going to transfer the same dramas and conflicts
into space?
Good
word, Lucy, worry. You use the word, do I worry about it?
Well, it seemed to me that your book was a thesis. It was a warning shot across the bows to say we are in danger of making the same mistakes intergalactically as we've done on this planet.
I think it's inevitable, because why wouldn't we? If you look back at the 12,000 years of recorded history and all the mistakes we've made, we're not suddenly going to stop, are we? This is why I'm quite sanguine, and actually it's not that I don't worry about it. It's just that there's almost an inevitability about it. You know, I don't despair at humanity's propensity to keep going to war, because I think it's part of the human condition, and it's a work in progress that we're trying to overcome. So what I'm trying to get at, and I swear, you know, this is, see, I know what you're doing here. This is the psychology bit. Yeah, yeah. And I've fallen for it. Hook, line, and sinker. No, sorry, because it is a genuine, almost political. Well, it is a political point. I accept our frailties and complexities and problems and our inability to share properly, and our primal fear of not trusting the other. And as I said, it's a very long work in progress. And I think we have gone a long way. If you just look at, you know, the Universal Declaration of Universal Human Rights, things like that, the concept of human rights, of gay rights, it's actually relatively, especially the latter, new in our thinking as human beings. You know, a couple of thousand years ago, if you want to try telling one culture that there's actually something fundamentally wrong with killing the other culture, that why? You know, we have moved on. Sorry, I'll try to come up to speed. So, given that we have this propensity for conflict, especially when we're nervous about things, I don't see why we're not going to take it out to space. And that was actually the reason I wrote the book, is that we need to be aware of what is coming in order to be able to hold back our propensity for suspicion and violence, which is why one of the central planks of the book is this call for proper, grown-up, well-thought-out and well-written and defined laws for space, because the ones we have, such as they are so completely out of date. We're having an arms race in space. We're going to have an even more of an arms race in space. That does not necessarily mean we have to have a war in space.
But it's a shame, going back to what we were talking about around Jordan, and this from my friend in Jordan who was saying, why do we have borders? Do you think there's ever the potential for us to conquer space on behalf of planet Earth, as opposed to staking a claim, this is Russia's flag on the moon, this is India's flag on the moon? Is there not an opportunity to say, let's pull together on this one?
Yes. And it is borne out in the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which says exactly that. Space is for the common good of humanity. But you can say what you like. I'm the one that's just spent $100 billion finding out where the rare earth metals are on the moon, and another $100 billion on building the technology to go there. I'm going there. No, of course you can't have it. So you can have a treaty that says it's for the common good of humanity. I'm still the one that's going to make the profit out of it. And if I find that you're also now trying to piggyback on the back of all my hard work, I'm afraid I'm going to declare a safety zone, which brings me to the Artemis Accords, which we have signed bilateral with the Americans, and many other countries have signed bilateral agreements. It says in the Artemis Accords, once you're there, you can declare a safety zone. Well, you and whose army is going to defend that safety zone? So it is inevitable. I mean, the difference at least this time is that we're not going to go and steal somebody else's land. You know,
not that we know.
No, unless it's the clangers for older listeners. Unless it's the clangers on the moon, and suddenly we realize, well, you're going to have to move, I'm afraid. That is a positive. We're not going to go and despoil someone else's territory, nor take it. This is barren land. There are people that say, oh, it'd be awful, wouldn't it, if we despoiled the moon? I don't really care. Despoil it. I'd rather despoil there than down here. I'd rather dig things up there rather than down here. But the idea that we will all the countries will come together and declare it common territory in which everything will be shared out equally. Well, it's never happened before, so why is it going to happen now?
Well, that's right. And you point very beautifully to these very primitive impulses that we all have, in a very Freudian sense. We are very competitive, but we're also very alert for the threats
success. But you know, Lucy, that we are also, and this, I don't know if this is a big divide in your world, but we have also absolutely always shown the ability to cooperate and to share when there is an abundance. It's just when there isn't an abundance,
yes,
there's a bit of a problem.
It's quite a sophisticated part of psychology, because you have to teach children how to share. You know, give little, you know, Leo his toy that he wants, because he wants to have a play with it as well. But you're right, altruism in particular would appear to confer no great advantage on any individual whatsoever. But actually, it's for the greater good of the group to do something benevolent, or to be a grandparent and to look after the grandchildren while the other people go out hunting and gathering. So,
and I do think you can apply that to international. You can international relations. Honestly, it's not that much different to the playground.
And that's very true. And in a way, that playground dimension of it means that there will always be some conflict or other. There will always be a squabble that will need to be resolved. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what I loved about your book, Prisoners of Geography, was that it was very much exploring a relationship that a country has to itself as much as to its neighbours. So its contours, its topography. And you wrote something that I have often thought, which is that, you know, there is a certain psychology of separateness, really, that might have had an influence here in the UK on the Brexit vote.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it's hard to prove some of this stuff, perhaps impossible, but I think an element in the Brexit vote is the fact we're an island. I think the psychological effect of that little strip of water on our psychology is quite profound. Now, you know, it doesn't mean you're a little Englander. It doesn't mean that you don't like the funny foreigners from, you know, over there. It just means there's this physical recognition of reality. And then if you go back through history, I think it's deep in the collective psyche that we know that that strip of water protected us, you know, in Napoleonic times, Second World War times, even before that. And also from some of the radical ideas that have swept through Europe and its blighted history over the past 200 or 300 years, including, I would say, communism and fascism. And we've never gone to those extremes. And I think, again, that the little strip of water is, you know, we've had our own extremes, don't get me wrong, Cromwell, civil wars, all sorts of things. So I just think that there is an element of that which was behind the Brexit vote.
Mm-hmm. Couple of final questions. I ask this of quite a few people, but you are a foreign affairs guru. So,
I'm not. I'm a generalist.
I'm taking my lead from this question from the sort of Macron Sunak bromance that appeared to exist maybe about a month or so ago, where the very fact that they seemed to get along just changed the dynamics and changed the kind of mood music around the relationship between Britain and France, as you would expect. You know, a lot can be achieved when leaders get along. On that note, where would you send Rishi Sunak now, tomorrow, to have the most impact geopolitically?
Briefly on the Macron, on the bromance. Macron has bromances with, you know, everybody. It doesn't always last long. He had a bromance with Trump. It is important. Personal relationships are important, and it's a lot better for them to be grinning toothily at each other than it is for Liz Truss to, you know, not even commit to whether France is a friend of ours, you know, which was a low point. I would have sent him. It wouldn't be Coventry. Xinjiang province in China.
For what reason?
Because they're busy locking up people there in the hundreds of thousands for the crime of being Muslim, sterilizing women. I think it would either open his eyes or reinforce his existing thinking of be aware of who we're dealing with. I'm not saying that we shouldn't deal with China. Of course we should. It's impossible not to economically. But I still think there are corners of society that do not realize what we're dealing with when it comes to communism in China. In fact, it's increasingly communism, nationalism, Chinese nationalism with Chinese nationalism with Chinese communist characteristics.
Yeah.
When you look at the torture, the corruption, the ruthlessness, the lack of free speech, the facial recognition technology, what they're doing to the Uyghurs, the settlements. 50% of Tibet is now Han Chinese, 50% of Xinjiang province is now Han Chinese, etc. Again, let's deal with China. Chinese people find a great, incredible culture and all the rest of it, but be clear-eyed that you are dealing with the 21st century's biggest dictatorship, ruthless, cold dictatorship, with at state level, very different values. And, you know, some people might be shouting at your podcast at the moment about the litany of British crimes and American crimes, and I'll join in your shouting and add a few more if you want. But that still doesn't mean you don't know who you're dealing with when you're dealing with 21st century China. And so just in case he has any lingering doubts, go to Xinjiang province. See what's happening. Well, I wouldn't let him, but there we are. Where's my point?
It would be an effort. Exactly. Finally, possibly the most important question.
Ooh.
As a devoted Leeds United fan and author of Dirty Northern Bastards and other tales from the terraces, the story of Britain's football chants, I would love to know your view of a slightly different competitive arms race, really. The foreign money owning England's football teams, overseas wealth funds, also Hollywood stars. I didn't realize that Ryan Reynolds owned a football club Wrexham. In the UK.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Oh, no, I never thought I'd find myself watching Wrexham versus Notts County, but I watched it live last week, and so did half of America, and Reynolds was there. Sorry, Carrie. What do I think of it? It's terrible, jaundiced, sanguine, realistic view I have. I'm actually quite an optimist, and I like people and I like society, but it's inevitable. It's where the money is, and the money will go after, and therefore money follows money. I mean, I don't particularly like it. You know, Man City being owned by Qatar, Newcastle by the Saudis, my own club Leeds. Did I tell you I was a home and away season ticket holder? It looks like
maybe
if
just
we stay
once
up,
on Twitter, yes.
If we stay up, and it's
when you stay up,
very
when?
Much in the balance. No, it really is. If we'll probably be bought by the San Francisco 49ers, and why not? It's a free country. As long as they don't Americanize the sport, because despite its many failings, I quite like some of the culture around good old English football. Some of it I don't. I think it's not. I don't think it's in the final analysis. I don't think it's that healthy. It does. It has made. It's one of the things that has made the Premier League the best league in the world with the best players, and it's fantastic to watch them rolling around on the turf, banging it as if they've just been shot, cheating their way to the title, things like that. It's great.
But, and the soft power of that. I remember being in the middle of absolutely nowhere in Burma, in Myanmar, and having little boys running up to us wearing T-shirts with, you know.
Well, I have single-handedly distributed Leeds United shirts all over the world, including in Iraq. But that's another story. No, I don't think it's positive. I do think it's inevitable. I hope that the footballing powers keep a weather eye on it and try to temper some of the excesses. And yes, if you're talking about a sovereign wealth fund, which is what you're talking about with Newcastle and Man City, then it is part of soft power to wash your money through that in order to make your dictatorship known for other things than ripping people's toenails out or their metatarsals in this particular argument. If you're talking about the San Francisco 49ers, not just because I'm a Leeds fan, I have less of a problem with it. Yes, it is, you know, rapacious capitalist money coming into our game, but it's better than soft power.
Jim Marshall, author of numerous books, including the new one, The Future of Geography. Thank you.
Future of Geography. And thank you for letting me get so much off my chest, Lucy.
That's why it's called On My Couch.
Yeah.
Until we speak again, thank you.